Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I'm Robert Rosenthal, Executive Director of the Center for Investigative Reporting and your moderator for the program. We also welcome our listeners on radio and invite everyone to visit us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. This program is being held in association with the Commonwealth Club's Middle East Forum. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Dr. James Zoghbi, founder and president of the Arab American Institute and author of the new book, Arab Voices, What They Are Saying to Us and Why It Matters. Dr. Zoghbi has probably as much experience as anyone in working in the Middle East. He's spent the last 40 years in every country in the Middle East, talking to countless people, polling, and really listening. It's a privilege to have him here tonight. Please welcome Dr. James Zoghbi.
Thank you, Robert. I'm so pleased to be here at the Commonwealth Club. It's the first of my speeches on the road with my new book. And it's especially delightful to be here because one of the very first large public gatherings I had the opportunity to speak at many, many decades ago was a Commonwealth Club event that I was invited to speak at sometime in the 80s, I forget, but it was one of the first big forums that invited me, and I was delighted then, and I'm delighted now. My daughter, Mary Margaret, has come with me on the beginning of this book tour, and I took with great note your comment about the importance of the family dinner. Mary Margaret and I looked at each other, and that's something that in my family with my five children has always been a pretty critical part of our success, actually, as a family growing up together. I'm pleased to talk about the book, and that's something that I hope I can create a bit of enthusiasm about the book and maybe spur you on to buy a copy and share it with friends. I wrote the book to sort of talk about a number of issues and observations that I've been itching to get down on paper for many, many decades. There are several reasons why I thought the book was important to write. One of them came through to me in a question today from one of the radio shows I did. They can be kind of irritating sometimes, but when you get the questions that you want to scratch your head and say, he needs to read the book, you know that you wrote it for the right reason. The question was, what do we need to listen to these people for anyway? What do they have to offer? They're just backward, and they're violent, and we just ought to ignore them. Well, the simple fact is that we can't, and we have not. And we are so heavily invested in that region. I put it this way. In the last 30 years, we've sent more money, we've sent more troops, we've sent more weapons, we have fought more wars and lost more lives. We have more critical national security interests at stake in that region than anywhere else in the world. And we've expended more diplomatic capital in that region. Every presidency since the 1970s has risen or fallen on its ability to manage the conflicts in the Middle East. And so it's not a question of should we or shouldn't we listen. We have to listen. The problem is we don't. And let me add a couple of data points to that, the enormity of our interests in the region. And I don't just mean economic interests. I mean we have 150,000 troops fighting in and around that area. We have not just Israel, which you always like to say is our number one ally, but we have other countries in the region that have been closely allied with us, with whom we have long-standing ties. and deep personal ties. I could speak of just the country of my father's origin, Lebanon, which has a longstanding tie with the United States of America. But there are other factors as well that we could point to. With all this going on, we just did a poll a year ago, asked Americans to point to Iraq on a map. A third could find Iraq on a map. After having lost 4,400 troops, a third of our people know where the country is, where 4,400 of our folks died. We asked people to give us the year of Israel's independence. Only about a third could do that. Two-thirds thought that Iraq and Pakistan were Arab countries. The fact is that we don't know. We're invested in a region. We're dying in a region. We have interests at stake in a region. Most of us don't have a clue about that region. And when I get the question, well, you know, these people are all violent, and these people are all this, and they're just religious fanatics. What do I need to know about them for? Well, the issue is that they're not. That they are like people everywhere. And we have to take time to understand that, and it's something that we have not done. I tell the story all the time about when I was living in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. I'd lived in Philadelphia for about 6 years and moved from there to Carlisle, a little town in the south-central part of the state. Guy next door to me said, "You came from Philadelphia?" I said, "Yeah, I did." He said, you lived there?" I said, "Yeah, I did." He said, you lived there? Like, lived in the city?" I said, "Yeah, I did." He said, "Weren't you scared?" I said, "Well, no, not really. No, why?" He said, "People get murdered there every day. I read about it in the paper." And the fact is that the news we get about the Middle East is always bad news. And so the impression is that it is a bad news place. The voices we do hear are the most extreme. It's as if people in the Middle East were only to listen to Terry Jones, the wacko who was going to burn a Quran. If he defined America, we'd be in trouble. But the fact is that we have an ability to broadcast a larger message about who we are. The Arab world doesn't. And so in this country, the voices that get heard are the angry ones. The actions that get seen are the murderous ones. And the whole region is defined, therefore, by stereotypes, which is why we get the kind of results that we get when we poll Americans about the Middle East. Favorable attitude toward Arabs. You get about a 43 favorable, 41 unfavorable. Among Democrats, it's 60-30 favorable, unfavorable. Among Republicans, it's 28-65 unfavorable. When you ask favorability toward Muslims, among Democrats, it's about 58-35. And among Republicans, it's 12 favorable, 85 unfavorable. Those are scary numbers about a deep partisan divide in a region, with regard to a region that is critical, as General Petraeus says, to our national security interests. So that's the second data point. Number one, the heavy investment. Number two, fact we don't know. And the number three is this issue of the myths that dominate our national discussion about who Arabs are. They're all angry. Why do Arabs not have a favorable attitude toward America? What our polls tell us is that two-thirds of Americans say it's because they hate our values. So we looked at all of this. We looked at all of this. And what we decided to do was some polling in depth in the region that would help open up a window, if you will, to let Arab voices in. We've been doing it now for about 10 years, going to a number of countries, polling in depth almost twice a year. And the book gives you the results of the most recent, but also the trajectory over the last 10 years. What the book is not is what I call bad science. The bad science being the guy writes the book about the, I met this person, and he told me that Arabs are this. You know, you take an observation, you raise it to a generalized conclusion, and you then say all Arabs, i.e. all black people jump higher, all Hispanics are this, and all Jews are that, you know, that kind of thing. I don't do that. We tell stories. I do love to tell stories about Arabs that I've known and stories that have been told to me and people who have been meaningful in my life. But I use the stories to amplify the hard data. I want the voices of the Arabs to speak for themselves. And so the book is is focused on what Arabs are saying. I take five myths, the myths that we have about Arabs, and I kind of pull them apart by looking at the hard data first. Are Arabs all the same? That's one myth we have. We write a book that we publish here in America that has been used by the U.S. military as a standard guide to dealing with the Arab world. It's called The Arab Mind. And The Arab Mind by Raphael Patai had generalized conclusions about the Arabs and who they are and how they think. Humiliation. It was the book, actually, that led to Abu Ghraib by arguing that Arabs only understood humiliation and overwhelming violence, what was necessary to change them, and that sexual humiliation was the worst form of degradation, and therefore, if you did that, and the conclusions were there and played out for all of us with tragic consequences. The problem is that there is no Arab mind, just like there's no Jewish mind. Patai wrote that book too, very different conclusions. There is no British mind. What there are people who are diverse in and among themselves, and in some cases have different attitudes at the same time toward similar events. So, for example, we talk to people in Morocco. We talk to people in Egypt and in Lebanon. And the local customs, in fact, shape. The history of Morocco is different than the history of Egypt. And so there's a different set of cultural values that are shared in each country. Or in Lebanon, or in the local conditions create local uniqueness. And I want the uniqueness to speak out, so we ask people about their own countries. What do you think about this? Or what do you think of, what is the most important thing about your own country? And we let the diversity speak. And it really is quite striking when you see 4,000 Arabs giving open-ended questions. What's the best thing about your country? What's the worst thing about your country? What's the thing about your country you most want Americans to know? And then you document them all. You respect them as individual voices. You then categorize them. And by age and by gender, and then you present the findings, which is one of the things we do in the book. Enormous diversity and wonderful diversity. And in fact, within itself, a mosaic that is very rich. It was on display at the Kennedy Center in an artful way last year during a program called Arabesque, where you had this incredible array of Arab talent from Moroccan, Berber musicians to a Syrian choral group of children singing beautiful music, making beautiful music, and then a Lebanese jazz fusion artist and a Somali hip-hop singer. And it was just an incredible array of this diversity that is the Arab world today, and was attended by many but still too few folks in our country to appreciate the richness of the culture of the Arab world. I thought when I was there, something that Golda Meir had said, I read it in a Time magazine article when Israel was having its 25th anniversary, and she said, I feel bad for the other side. We over here, we make music and we make love and we have joy, but they only know how to hate and make war. And that image of an angry people, that's another one of the myths that we decided to take on. Are Arabs just angry? Part of the problem is that the only pictures we see are people shaking their fist and demonstrations of Hamas or Hezbollah or something like that. And got the question today about, well, you say they like us, why are they all so angry and demonstrating all the time? And don't they ever just do things like normal people? Well, the answer is yes, that's the truth. I mean, the image that we have is of a people who go to bed at night hating America, wake up in the morning hating Israel, and spend the day watching television, that news shows that fuel the hatred, or going to the mosque and hearing a preacher making them even angrier. Well, when we poll, what we find is that the number one concern of most Arabs is their job and their economic security. And their number two concern is health care. And the number three concern is improving educational system for their kids. Sound familiar? It's like most people everywhere. And after that, in order, you get the rest of the issues down the line. But the interesting thing is that when you ask them what they watch on television, yes, they do watch the news sometimes, but their number one rated show in Saudi Arabia, number one rated shows are movies. And after that come soap operas, and Egypt is they're also big. And after soap operas and dramas, they love to watch game shows and reality shows. The Regis, You Want to Be a Millionaire, there was actually a franchised version of that in the Arab world. It was a top-rated show for a long time. Reality shows, yes. Also music shows like The American Idol. They don't call it The American Idol. They call it something else. But they have these programs, and they have programs actually about poetry. People doing free verse poetry, and they do the same thing as American Idol. The guy who wins in the show actually goes on so long and is rated so high that my program gets bumped every once in a while when they have one of these contests, so I know it's doing well. Religious programming exists, just like it exists here. But in our rating system, when we ask people preferences, what they watch, it's about 7 out of the 8. It's number 7 out of the 8 shows, the types of shows that we ask them. So no, they're not spending their time fueling their anger, watching the news, or listening to preachers preach. They're actually watching movies and being entertained. They watch television just like the rest of us watch television. And they exercise their thumb on the remote control just like the rest of us. Well, if Arabs aren't all angry and they aren't all the same, the other myth is that they're so different that they don't really constitute a world at all, that they're so unique. Each one of the Lebanon, they're not Arabs, they're Lebanese, and the Egyptians are. Well, what we find in our polling is something quite different. Yes, they are unique cultures in different ways, and yes, they have different kinds of backgrounds that play out in important ways in shaping their lives, but there also are some common threads that unite them as a people. And those common threads are critical and cannot be ignored. When we ask people how they self-identify, Arab is near the top in their rating. But when we ask them, is Arab identity important to you? It is to about 80 to 85% across the board. And we ask them what it means, what this identity means to them, it's a series of common and shared political concerns that fuse them to the rest of the polity in the region. When we ask Moroccans, how important is the Palestine issue to you? Or ask people in the Emirates, or ask people in Egypt, or Lebanon, or Jordan, or wherever we're polling at the time, how important this is to you, and it comes in the top ranking among 50% to two-thirds of the population. That's important, and it is a shared issue. And it's not a foreign policy question to them. One of the things we find as we unearth it and look at it, and I talk about in the book, is that it's an existential question. It's a defining issue in the culture. I call it the open wound that never healed. It's a, it is a symbol of vulnerability. It's a symbol of a personal loss that was never fulfilled. In some ways, and I do not mean this in any way to appear disrespectful to the feelings of some, but it compares to the Holocaust in its meaning. Certainly not in its event. There is no Palestinian Holocaust, thank God, that 6 million have not been murdered. I don't mean it that way. What I mean is that when I speak to American Jews and they tell me what the Holocaust means to them, when I speak to American Jews, especially those who lived through that period, and they tell me how they felt when they first began to learn about it, it was people like them who made them feel vulnerable about themselves. And it was people like them, something happening far away, but striking them in the core of their hearts, creating a wound that wouldn't heal. And that's how Arabs looked at Palestine. It was something that is happening to people like them, far away, but speaking to their heart about themselves and about their vulnerability and their loss of control in history. And it's a hurt. And when America ignores it, we do so at great risk of making huge mistakes, as we have continually made in that region, thinking in different periods as we have, oh, that one's over, we don't have to worry about it anymore. And then it would rear its head, and we would be reminded of how powerful a motivating issue and symbol this is to people across the region. The last of the myths is this issue of the Arabs don't change. They're stuck in the background, in the past, and they're not going anywhere. I use a story. It's actually a poem from pre-Islamic times called. I call it the Frozen Camel. The period is called the Jahiliyyah period. It's the period before at the time of the rise of Islam, but it's the period, it defines the period in the poetry pre-Islam. And there's a poem that really struck me back when I was doing my doctoral work, and I wrote a long paper about it, and it stayed with me ever since. The poet describes a camel in the desert, and the camel is running in the scene that he is sort of laying out in this poem. And he's running, and the poet senses fear in the camel's eyes. And at one point, the camel stops. And he stops, and he looks back, and he's afraid. Afraid of the danger that he has been running from. But as he looks forward, the poet notes fear again, because he doesn't know where he's going to. And the sense of being stuck, not knowing where you've come from, and not knowing if you can go back, but not knowing where you're going to and what dangers may lie ahead, are the situation that is not just true about the Arab world today, but it's true about everybody. It actually describes almost every critical period in history when great changes are taking place. When I look at the Tea Party, and I saw last summer in those healthcare town halls that were convened around the country, and I looked in the eyes of the folks who were at those things, and then people try to intellectualize and tell me what's going on.
Well, they're all angry at the deficit. And they're just furious about the fact that our government has gotten too big and is out of control.
That's not what's going on. People are afraid. People have lost control. People don't know where they're going. And it is logical. If you weren't afraid, it wouldn't be logical. Understand what's happening in our country today. This is the first generation of Americans who are in the middle class, who do not believe that their children will be in the middle class, who do not believe their children will reach the level of prosperity that they've reached for themselves. This is the first generation of Americans who are not looking forward but are looking backward, because they have no confidence in the future and no confidence in the ability of government. Started when we got lied to about Iraq, and people knew it in their gut this wasn't right and wasn't working. And it caused a tremendous loss of confidence, coupled with Katrina, which was a devastating blow. I mean, 9/11 brought America together, but the Iraq War and the situation with Katrina pulled us apart and had us lose a sense of belief in the power of government to actually do things right. And that has only been reinforced in the last several years in many, many ways. And so people are stuck in this mindset of fear and anxiety, and that has produced the anger, and it's produced the backlash, and it's produced believing in myths and conspiracies of all sorts. He's a Muslim, and he's not born here, and he's whatever, and they just go on and on and on with stuff, none of which I take seriously as real, all of which I understand are symptoms of the enormous insecurity that we're living with today. Now, in the Arab world, the transformation is so rapid that it has caused this kind of insecurity in many ways. I mean, if you look at Abu Dhabi as a city, or you look at Riyadh as a city, first time I went there was in late 1970s, early 80s. But if you think about it, if you went back just 20 years before, in the 50s, Riyadh had 45,000 people, and it was mostly mud and brick. It was a small burg in the middle of the desert. Today it's 4.5 million people, and it works. It works. I mean, the flow of traffic is amazing. There are jams like there is in every big city, but to think that in just 60 years, the rapidness of that transformation of this area into a metropolis of 4.5 million people with power and water and jobs and the arteries of transportation that actually move people in the right direction, I mean, it's almost magical that it works. And Abu Dhabi is the same thing on a smaller scale. It was about 10,000 to 15,000 people in the 50s, and today it's 1.5 million people, and it's a gorgeous city that works. Now, what happens in the context of that rapid change? is some insecurity. I mean, if you want to understand the phenomena of fundamentalism, part of the phenomena of fundamentalism comes from, as it does here. I mean, you know, the problem of fundamentalism in the South going back when you had movements of the sort that we had back in the 20s and 30s, had a lot to do with urbanization, and after World War II, more urbanization. And what that urbanization meant was that guys coming in from the farm, moving into the city, and then reacting to the city ways, and going backward, looking for a way to purify and be like good, solid Baptists, because that was the good way, and these evil city ways. And so you have this phenomena of fundamentalism everywhere in the world, wherever you have rapid transformation. And we have leadership in our country. Some try to exploit it, and some try to resolve it. And in their countries, they have people, some of whom are trying to exploit that insecurity, and then you have leadership in the government that's trying to resolve it and move the country, edge the country forward out of the trauma of rapid change that has affected everybody. And change is coming. We ask in Saudi Arabia and in other Arab countries, how do you feel about women in the workplace? About 75% say that they think it's a good idea. Ask people about whether or not there ought to be reforms of this, that, or the other. Yes. But the interesting thing, and I have a chapter about it in the book, is ask them, and this is a story I'll tell you, just one story about it. I was working with a think tank in Washington that wanted to interview people about reform issues in the Middle East. So we went to Saudi Arabia. And one of the guys we met was a member of the Majlis al-Shura, and that is the sort of the appointed Senate that actually today has gained significant power in the country in terms of being able to review legislation and pass legislation and review the budget and actually veto things that they think are wrong. And they've been able to stand up to ministries in government and make some really important decisions. And one of the guys who was a friend of mine happens to be one of these great reformers. He was approached the day before we came out there on our little mission to ask these questions in 9 different Arab countries. He had just stood up in the Majlis when asked by the transportation minister for an increase in a road tax. He said, "We're not giving you a road tax. If you don't show us the budget, we're not giving you the tax. Why would we want to give you more money if you won't be accountable to us for the money that you've already got?" And he went on, and he was laughing, and the other guys who were at the meeting with us were also members of the Majlis, and they were laughing that the whole program was carried on Saudi 3, which is the equivalent of their C-SPAN, and he'd become a bit of a local hero. People had stopped him on the street and said, "You know, we saw you on television, good for standing up," and whatever. So the first question from this group, because they'd made these questions that were pat questions to be asked of every group we interviewed in every country, first question was, "President Bush has enunciated a reform agenda. Do you support that reform agenda for democracy?" He went off the wall. "We don't need it. We don't want it. You can keep your reform. I can tell you what you can do with it and where you can put it." And he went on. And so the guy from the think tank in Washington turned to me and said, "I thought you said he was a reformer." I said, "Yeah, but you've put George Bush in the sentence." The fact is that this is not the reform they want. They want their reform, not ours. We have become damaged goods. Remember, just around the time we were doing this, Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo, and there was Iraq. And the point is that in the middle of roiling a region and undercutting all of our values, we're talking about reform and democracy. And it's like, what? What genius thought these talking points up? And so that's what we got. Was that they do want reform, and they're acting on reform, and civil society is growing. But the interesting thing is that the war in Iraq, we were told, would spread democracy. It retarded democracy. Because what it did was it inflamed passions, it created instability, it forced leaders, some of whom were moving in the direction of reform, to hold off because they frankly were afraid of what was happening. And in areas where democracy moved forward, what happened? The guys who won weren't the guys that we were interested in winning. Whereupon we immediately rejected the outcome of the elections that we didn't like, and the setback was complete everywhere. And so the fact is that we have not been the articulators or the we've not been smart in the way we've articulated these issues or in the programs that we've put across in an effort to implement them. And so the book does the following. It explores the myths. It tells some stories. It talks about the interests we have and how we don't know enough to meet those interests. We're victims of our own ignorance in that regard. And because of our ignorance, our leaders have been able to sell us a bill of goods. I mean, remember the, and I quote each one of them in the book, it'll take 6 days, 6 months and we'll be out of there. It'll cost about $2 billion. Democracy will bloom and spread throughout the whole Middle East. Anybody who says that Sunni and Shia can't get along, that's just pop psychology. I don't buy it. Bill O'Reilly was betting people the best dinner in the Gaslight District in San Diego if this war wasn't over in a week. And on and on and on. There's no accountability. I mean, if you were a baseball player and had the same batting average as these guys, you wouldn't be in the minor leagues. You'd be in jail for forfeiting contract. I mean, it's like you didn't belong in the big leagues to begin with. You lied about that. But these guys told these stories because people didn't understand or know. I mean, our people were sold a bill of goods about Iraq. It was a country we couldn't, back then, National Geographic did a poll about Iraq. 11% of Americans could find it on a map back in 2003. We sent 100-something thousand troops into a country where only 11% of our people could find it. And 4 years later, we polled again, and it was up to 35%. And today it's 37%. I mean, we have a problem. And the book tries to deal with that problem by saying, let us understand this region where we are engaged so heavily. And after looking at the myths and looking at the problems, and then looking at the blunders that we've gotten into because of it, I then talk at the end of the book about some of the things that are actually working right. And I think they are. And there are areas of getting it right that need to be built upon. And I start with the president in Cairo, because I think he actually did an extraordinary job of setting an agenda of how to restore a relationship with a region that we desperately need to have a better relationship with. But I was on television that very day, on CNN and on CBS and ABC and a number of other shows. I debated Liz Cheney a couple times and another time with George Allen. They elected him. I didn't. And they had the same talking points, the two of them. It was, he betrayed our values. He apologized to terrorists. He embarrassed the American people overseas, and on and on and on. That was the argument they made. I was asked at one of the interviews on CBS, I said, do you think that he can actually heal the divide between America and the Arab world? And I said, that's going to be an easier job than healing the divide with Republicans here at home, because they won't give him a break. They won't give him a break at all. And so one of the reasons why we've been set back is because this agenda of the pieces that needed to be changed in order to move us forward in the relationship have been difficult to put through. We still can't close Guantanamo, in part because a hysteria campaign was developed and Democrats got cowardly and backed away, and the president got stuck with a promise that actually was, when we first polled after his election, the most consequential move that he made was closing Guantanamo and ending torture. And one of those two, he can't deliver on, because they won't let him close it. President trying to get it right, sometimes being tone deaf, but still trying to get it right. And I look at his flaws as well as some of his good points. But there are other programs in the government that are good. And I think that some of the things we're doing now with our aid programs are really smart. I wasn't always a fan of our AID programs. I used to call them, you know, they were like guys in with those green garters on their sleeves and those visors sitting in the bowels of the agency thinking up all these programs, got money to spend and we'll do it and this. But what's happened, actually began with Karen Hughes, and I don't want to take credit for it, a lot of credit, but I think some of it came from a long conversation she and I had where she didn't listen to half of it, but the other half she did listen to. And that was, I said, our program should be demand-driven. Don't give people what they don't want. Give them what they're asking for. And let them, in part, define some of the aid they want. I mean, it's sort of like helping the little old lady across the street when she doesn't want to go. I mean, see where she wants to go, and then maybe offer her help. And if that works, then you got a deal. And now we've changed our programs, and our programs actually are partnerships. And we don't say we're doing a micro-whatever program for this area. We ask people in the region, what do you want? And then we see if we can actually work with them, and we find a local partner, and we work with a local partner to promote the entrepreneurial training program or the... I remember the Fouad Atiyah is here, a friend of mine. He is a Palestinian businessman in this community, and one of the things I did during the 90s was called Builders for Peace with Vice President Gore. And I was at the Economic Summit in Casablanca running the session on the Palestinian economy. We had three ministers from the Palestinian economy there. And at the end of the program, they were telling about what they needed and what they had to happen and the impediments to economic growth and the fact that they couldn't export and couldn't import and couldn't do this and couldn't do that. And some guy comes up to me. He was a very young person. He had basically had one job when he got out of school, and that's working for AID. He did it for 4 years. And he came up to me and told me, he said, I just got the $9.3 million contract from AID to teach entrepreneurialism to Palestinians in the West Bank. Could I meet the ministers? I want to talk to them about what my plans are. And I told one of the ministers, and he said, what? That's the aid that they promised us. They never talked to us about this. And basically the thing is, if you know Palestinians, they don't need to be taught entrepreneurialism. You know, a couple nickels and they'll do business with you. They wanted to free up the economic environment to do business, not have some kid who never held a job in his life teach them how to be entrepreneurs. And so they've changed that now. It's a good thing. And I write about the good programs that we're doing that are really working. I write about programs like SIPE, the Center for Investment in Private Enterprise, a marvelous program run by the Chamber of Commerce that does wonderful work in supporting the infrastructure of civil society. Then I talk about some of the U.S. corporations that I have enormous respect for, operating in the region, that actually are the best public diplomats we have. I mean, people in the Middle East go to a Pizza Hut, not because the food's better, but they want a little piece of America. One of the people I interview and I write about in the book tells me, we love your country. We sometimes don't think your country loves us. We feel like jilted lovers a little bit. But he said, the difference between you and Germany and Japan and China, the other great exporters, is they export products, but you export a way of life. And people here want a piece of that, which is why they'll go to a Starbucks, which is why they'll go to McDonald's, which is why they go to Kentucky Fried Chicken. Because things that we don't do here, although you can't really avoid Starbucks here. My daughter was noting on the way in that, like, if there wasn't one in your eyesight, what, do you get insecure out here or something like that? It's like, oh, there's not one on this block. I don't know. I don't feel good about myself right now. But these are franchises growing rapidly in the Middle East, and they're growing because people want a piece of America. Do they hate our way of life? No. They actually like it. They actually like us as people, but they don't feel we like them. And frankly, we have not, if you judge us, not by what we say about ourselves, by what we've done, the record doesn't speak well to how we've treated them. The final chapter of the book deals with you and I and everybody else in cities across the country who can get it right in their own ways. I always tell folks that, like, when I used to teach, I used to have my students, each of them take a different Arab country, and because today you can find every major country and its newspapers online. And not only are the papers online, but those newspapers all have comment sections, and you can engage in conversation with people over an article that appeared in the Al Arabiya website or on the Arab News website or the Gulf News website or whatever. And the fact is that if you read, as I would make them read that paper for 3 months, you begin to get a feel for daily life, not just the issues of national importance, but if you read the local news columns or the letters to the editor or the even some of the classifieds, you begin to get a feel for the nuance of life, and it opens up a window that creates a real familiarity. And my students loved it at the end of their experience. I tell them that because that's what I always do. My wife and I would travel, and we'd go to Ireland for a week. And, you know, within the third day I'm there, I'm so heavily invested in the debate over whether Lisbon is going to pass or not pass that I'm, like, asking people on the street, what's this about and where do you stand on it? And if you read the paper of a country, you get the feel for that country in a way that you wouldn't if you were just a passive participant in the reading the American paper and seeing how we're filtering the news that's important to us. Read the news important to them. And so in the back of the book, I give you all the websites you can go to and all the organizations you can belong to and how people who don't have the benefit of a Commonwealth Club can join a World Affairs Council or become part of a Great Decision Series, or how your kids can participate in model UNs or in model Arab leagues where each kid gets a country, each school gets a country. And just like the model UN, they act out and they learn how to represent that country, some popular, some unpopular, but they still get to get inside the heads of another people. And that's a learning experience that can't be duplicated. And so there are lots of opportunities for us to do it, to get it right. And an informed citizenry ultimately can change the political debate in a country. I believe it, which is why I've been doing what I've been doing for 35 years. And I'm pleased to have the opportunity to put a lot of it in a book and share it with you. And I do hope you'll buy it, and I'd be happy to sign it for you tonight. So thank you all very much.
Our thanks to Dr. James Zogby, founder and president of the Arab American Institute, and the author of the new book, Arab Voices, What They Are Saying to Us and Why It Matters. It's now time for the audience question period. Dr. Zogby, we have a number of questions, so let's begin, and I'll begin with the most complicated one. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict, you know, and some of the charts in your polling show that with the U.S. involvement in Iraq, it's highly, highly unpopular. In a sense, the U.S. has been in conflict, you could argue, in some level, in the Middle East for almost 28 years. Since Lebanon in 82, 83, in various forms, maybe longer than any other area of the world that we've been involved in militarily. And really at the center of so much strife is that how you've talked a lot about possible solutions and some of the positive things. Where can that dialogue begin, and how can it begin right now?
First of all, let me just say that the book is available on Amazon, a little pitch. One of the stereotypes that's true is I'm Lebanese, and my dad was a grocer, and I come from that background, and I have a little couple stories about my dad doing business in the book that I hope he passed away many, many years ago, but I think he'd appreciate the stories I tell about him. And I inherited that gene, so buy the book. It's a you can find out information about it, not on Amazon only, but it's called ArabVoicesBook.com, and it's available there, and reviews, et cetera, are on that site. What can we do about it? I think the first thing we have to do about it is demythify the conflict. You know, the notion that this has been in existence for thousands of years, not true. It's decades, not thousands. And it is two competing narratives, one of which we understand and the other of which we don't. Actually, one of which we understand and the other of which we have accepted the negative narrative, which is told by the other side. I mean, when most Americans' understanding of this conflict comes from the movie The Exodus. It was seen by millions. The book was read by even many more millions. And even those who didn't see it are the beneficiaries or the recipients, I would say, of the stereotype of the conflict that it created. And it was very clever. Leon Uris was very clever in writing it, because what he did was he played off of the cowboy and Indian myth. It was the pioneers going on the frontier, trying to free themselves and free the frontier so that they could share a divine future, and they were facing these savages who wanted to hold them back and didn't share the same values that they did. And he just transposed onto that the Arab and the Israeli side. The Israeli side was civilization. The Arab side was barbarism. They were the savages, and they just didn't get it. You couldn't trust them. And those stereotypes have stuck till now. The problem is that even when we try to understand it, we fit it back into that mold. So the first thing that has to happen, I think, is that we as Americans have to deconstruct that mythology and understand the Palestinian narrative, which does not mean to deny the Israeli narrative. These are two competing narratives, but they have to be reconciled ultimately. And there is a vision to reconcile them, to treat both as respected human communities.
and to treat their rights as rights that have to be acknowledged and reconciled, which may not mean that everybody gets everything they want. But the starting point can't be that one side gets everything and then gets to decide what the other side gets, which is the way we usually do it. Okay, we built this settlement and it's now an accepted fact, so get over it, buddy. Now tell me what else I can do. No. The Jordan Valley, that's ours. We need that for security reasons in Jerusalem. Don't even talk about it. We're not going there. You know, that's not helping the situation at all. And I think that even the best of our diplomats don't get that. One of the reasons why I think that we're stuck right now is because George Mitchell does get it. He begins this with a clean slate, and he's trying to do it, but he's fighting. He's fighting hard, and he's fighting against obstacles everywhere. Congress has given him a hard time. The Senate, 80-something senators sent a letter, don't do this, don't do that. It's a bit tough. But I do think that it is possible. I think that if you talk to, as we do, and I quote in the book, polls of American Jews and Arab Americans, you'll find most Americans get it. Most American Jews get it. Most Arab Americans get it. There is a constituency for peace in America. It needs leadership that will reflect what the constituency of American voters want. We want a balanced policy. That's what the polling tells us. We want a policy that doesn't favor either side but strikes a middle course. I think the president, if he stuck to his guns on this, he could do it and mobilize and create a new center. But it's going to take political courage to do it. But there is a path forward.
So when you look again at the picture now, what's the role now with the Iranian influence in, like, Lebanon? Ahmadinejad was just there. Hezbollah is a power. We know about the rhetoric. Even if the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is assuaged somehow or quieted down, what will be the Iranian role in now?
I'm a Democrat, in case anybody didn't know that. But one of the smartest diplomats I ever had the pleasure to know and deal with was Jim Baker. And I will never, ever forget, it was September 4th. It was the year that Saddam invaded Kuwait. And a guy who became a colleague of mine later in Builders for Peace, he was the co-chair on the other side, Mel Levine, congressman from down L.A. way, was asking the questions in the Foreign Affairs Committee, and he said, Secretary Baker, he said, the Palestinians are supporting Saddam, and doesn't that mean that we should just give up on them and just drop this effort to make Middle East peace because these people just can't be trusted? And Baker said no. He said it becomes all the more important because Saddam appears to them as the champion of the oppressed. That's the source of his power. And the degree to which we can pull the rug out from under him, it will isolate him, and it will make him more vulnerable in the region. But the degree to which we ignore it, to that degree, we make him stronger. Now, I wrote a piece just last week. My column last week was on Ahmadinejad's visit to Lebanon. And I compared it to, maybe unpopular with some, I don't care, but a very dear friend of mine who passed away a month ago, Ron Walters, one of the most brilliant political analysts I'd ever had the pleasure to know, taught at University of Maryland, and I'd known him from back when he worked with the Black Caucus and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference's foreign policy advisor, and then for a long time with Jesse Jackson. He was chair of African American Studies at Howard. But during the 84 presidential campaign, when I was working with Reverend and spent a lot of time out here in San Francisco, actually I was the deputy campaign manager. We had our convention here in town. Farrakhan has given us a hard time. And taking advantage of every opportunity to hot dog and to sort of create controversy that would then cause a backlash. And at one point I said to Ron, what's going on here? He said, you have to understand Farrakhan. He is, and this is the term he used, he said, he is the measure of the depth of black alienation from white America. He knows people are alienated and that people are angry. And he knows that he can create controversy by poking that and provoking that and by getting people outraged. And so when he pokes at the Jewish establishment or when he pokes at whites, and he gets them editorializing against him and denouncing them, he knows that his constituency in the black community is themselves so alienated that they will rise to defend him. And so he continually plays that game by putting himself in the center. He's not interested in a solution. He's not interested in making anything better. He's interested in being in the center and having all the attention focused on him. That's Ahmadinejad. He didn't give a damn about Lebanon. It's a plaything for him. He's provoking and he's provoking and provoking in order to be the center of attention. And why is he the center of attention? Because people are alienated and people are frustrated. And yes, the Shia community in Lebanon is disenfranchised. And they have been being preyed on because of their disenfranchisement for a long time. Preyed on by political movements in Lebanon and by others outside of Lebanon. The point is, Lebanon needs reform. I'm Lebanese, but the country needs reform. And there are those in the country wanting to get reform, but America hasn't been helpful to that reform. And the Shia community needs more political enfranchisement in the country. And the Palestinians need their rights. If we began to move in the direction of solving problems, we would take the ground away from these provocateurs, as Baker wisely noted, and they would not have the fertile ground to play the games that they play. It's just that simple. Iran is a function of the region's problems. And look, you know, one of the things I have no patience with when I debate folks on the right about the Iranian thing, you don't want to stand up to Iran? I say, man, you know, Iran was a manageable situation 10 years ago. It was manageable 10 years ago. Your foolish war in Iraq is what emboldened and empowered Iran. Number one, you took away their enemy on the one side, the Taliban. Number two, you took away their enemy on the other side, Saddam. Not that I had any good feeling about either one, but somebody should have thought that in the middle of all of that, what was going to happen to Iran? They became emboldened. On the one hand, they became more powerful in the region. But number two, and Iraq has become part of their playground now, where they're playing the same games there that they're playing elsewhere. But the other thing that they've done is they've created this festering wound in the Arab world where people look at the destruction of Iraq, they look at torture, and they look at Guantanamo, and they look at what we've done on the, or not done on the Palestinians, and what we've not done on Lebanon, and they look at all of that, and this anger makes them ripe for exploitation by the extremist movements on the one side or Iran on the other side. We've created this dilemma for ourselves. And how do you get out of it? You get out of it by backing out the way you got in. So deal with the problems that you created, and then as you peel the onion skins away, deal with Iraq and get Iraq. I mean, why we are negotiating with Iran or not negotiating with Iran about the nuclear question, I don't understand, frankly. That's not the number one issue in the region for Iran or anybody else. It's Iran's meddling in Lebanon and Palestine, in the Gulf region. The president promised us engagement. We need to engage Iran, not because we like them, but because they're a nuisance in the region. They're a problem. It's a problem country. But if we talk about the only issue that we can't solve, which is the nuclear one, and don't deal with them on the issues that we might be able to negotiate with them on, we need to sit down at the table with them and the Syrians and the Turks and the Kuwaitis and the Jordanians and the Saudis and have an all-party conference to talk about Iraq. You mean you want to let Iran in Iraq? Guess what? They're already in Iraq. But instead of having them play under the table in Iraq, you have to have them sitting at the table in Iraq. We did that with the Soviets, who were a threat. They really were a big threat. And we created a conference in Europe, a standing conference that stabilized the East-West relationship. We can stabilize the relationship in the Gulf that way. But we have to have the political will to do it and to not back off when somebody says, oh, you're appeasing the terrorist. What are we going to do? Make another war with Iran? If Iraq was a nightmare, Iran would be a double nightmare, not one you want to go into. So I frankly think that it is a situation, but the president's instinct was right. Engagement is a solution. We just have backed off of engagement too soon. Sorry, a long answer to a short question. Buy the book.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speaker today is Dr. James Zoghbi, founder and president of the Arab American Institute, who is discussing the results of a new survey regarding attitudes in the Arab world towards the U.S. We'll move it by geography. Here's a question from the audience. What do you believe will happen with the Islamic Faith Center proposed to be near Ground Zero in New York? How will the Arab world react if this is established or if it's not established?
Well, you have to know Faisal Abdul-Rauf, who is himself a wonderfully moderate and thoughtful man. I frankly wouldn't have put it where he put it. I mean, I wouldn't have wanted to do that. But I think now we don't have a choice. As he himself notes, the fact is that if it isn't built, it sends the wrong message. And frankly, the rhetoric that it created from the right wing, from people like Newt Gingrich and Sarah Palin, was so disgraceful and so anti-Muslim that it was embarrassing to me as an American. Worse than Terry Jones are presidential aspirants who makes shameful comments about the religion of 1.5 billion people and about millions of our own citizens. And so right now I think we have got to go forward with this, and we've got to find a way to send the message. This is not about the Constitution. This is about who we are and how we define ourselves as a country. And we are not defining ourselves pretty if we use the Newt Gingrich model. We are defining ourselves right if we understand that what's happening to Muslims today is what happened to Irish Catholics in Manhattan. It's what happened to Jews a century ago. It's what happened to Italians in the South. It's what happened to every minority group. America, to be true to itself, has to be open, welcoming, and absorptive. That's the genius of who we are. And if we lose that, we lose a sense of our mission in the world. And I thank you all very much.
A couple of questions from the audience.
Oh,
we're not
okay.
Finished.
Okay.
A few more questions. A
sure.
Couple actually came on related to the role of women in the Arabic world.
Mm-hmm.
Are there, and literacy. So I don't know if you want to address that or can you address that. And it's sort of a stereotype from our point of view, the Western or American point of view, that Arab women don't really have much power and are sort of kept behind the scenes.
There is change, and the change is coming. And in some countries, it's more visible than in others. In the UAE, for example, you have greater percentage of women in the cabinet, greater percentage of women in the parliament than you do here in the United States. I think that if you look at where these countries started, and the time period in which they have been undergoing this kind of change, it's fairly rapid. Even, in Saudi Arabia today, opportunities for women are greater than they ever were. And you are getting changes in the workplace, and you're getting changes in civil society. And I therefore, am quite hopeful, especially when I look at public attitudes and you get 75% saying that women belong in the workplace or that women ought to have equal rights in our country. That's the kind of number we're getting from men and women alike. There was a time when we first started polling about 15 years ago, asking Saudi Arabia, should women have equal rights? Men said yes, women said no. The numbers were they were more traditional. And now you're getting changes where you're getting both genders moving forward on that issue. And King Abdullah has been an important player in moving the country forward. May God grant him many more years because he has actually made real progress, slowly, incrementally, smartly, trying to create change. In other countries, there is also real progress on this front. Not enough. But, there's a lot of women in America who tell you we haven't made a lot of progress either. And within our lifetimes, we've seen a situation go from not very good to somewhat better, but not perfect yet. My mom, remember, she graduated from high school in the early 20s and gave her speech on stage. She ripped up the speech, and she was valedictorian, and she said, this was written for me by a man. And I'm giving my own speech. And she went on to talk about women's rights. And we didn't know about it until her 50th class reunion when her classmates spilled the beans. So Mom, who was always warning us to keep out of trouble when we were involved in civil rights and anti-war stuff, she lost her credibility on that one. But, that was in the last century. And we have been sorting out our problems here. And I think that I'm Christian enough to want to adhere to the maxim, which is actually not a maxim, but the New Testament saying of Jesus, to get the log out of your own eye before you deal with the splinter in your neighbor's. And
They have problems. They're dealing with those problems. They have leadership there that are addressing them. We can be helping them if we ask them, what do you want us to? But the thing they don't need is for Karen Hughes to come and lecture. They need us to help them make the changes they're ready to make. You can take a society the half step it's ready to take. You can't force it to take the step it's not ready to take.
So much in the Middle East and really around the world is driven by the extremes. So you've talked a lot about sort of the perception of the Arab world towards the U.S. We see a tremendous amount of vilification from our end here and demonization of that world. It also comes the other way.
Sure.
So how can you discuss a little bit about that and sort of how you see, is that perception getting worse of us or from their point of view, or do you see any ground moving in the, you know, as you've polled over, you know, 15 years?
The period from 2002 to 2008 was very frightening in terms of the steady downward tracking of American favorable numbers, so much so that when we did our first poll of this sort in 2002, I wrote an article called It's the Policy Stupid, because overall attitudes towards America were low, but attitudes towards the American people, toward culture, toward our values, toward our, you know, products, et cetera, were very high. It was our policy that were the really low numbers that dragged down the overall numbers. Sort of like, you know, when the Monica Lewinsky thing happened, and you asked, Clinton's numbers dropped. And if you asked a question about how's the president doing on this, all of his numbers went down. Or after 9/11, all of George Bush's numbers went up, including one that I never forgot. Somebody was asking it as a joke, and they said, who do you think reads more books? And George Bush beat Bill Clinton by about 15 points. And it was because 9/11 was the push, and Monica Lewinsky was still the drag on Clinton's numbers. And so that's what happens in a poll. Now, America's numbers get dragged down by our policy. And that doesn't mean they don't like us. It means that they don't like the overall impression of America because of those issues. Now, after the election of Barack Obama, he was the bounce that pulled everything up. And the numbers just shot up through the roof, and the numbers are in the book that way. Rather dramatic increases. They're settling back down because there's a bit of disappointment, but there still is a residual impact. The numbers are higher than they were.
Okay, unfortunately, we've reached the point in the program where we have one last question.
Sure.
So I'll give you a softball. I would like to look forward and have you look forward and really answer this question is, how can we regain the trust and respect of the Arab world? Is there too much bad blood? And conversely, how do we get both sides to really reach a common ground?
I would say that there's not bad blood, but there is a loss of confidence. I'll never forget the poignancy of a conversation I had with an Egyptian editor, major figure actually in Egyptian life. It was during the election, and I went over there on a lecture tour. I was actually speaking at the American University of Cairo, and I met with him. And I said, who do you think will win? Do you have a preference? And he said, I'm not going to say. And I said, why? He said, because I dare not hope. I've hoped too many times before, and I've been let down. I'm afraid to have hope again. And I saw him after the election, and he was feeling that hope again. I saw him after Cairo, and he was exhilarated. I saw him few months ago, and he feels like Charlie Brown in the football. The fact is that we have to be careful. I think that there remains this kind of residual sense that they want to be surprised by America. They want to be delighted by America. They're afraid sometimes to feel it. But I think that we, if we do the right thing and treat them as we would want them to treat us, and understand and acknowledge the times that we haven't treated them well. And if we just think about Iraq and think about the various behaviors that we exhibited in just that conflict alone, you get a good sense from their perspective of how we've let them down. That can change if we do the right thing.
Okay. Our thanks to Dr. James Zoghbi, founder and president of the Arab American Institute and author of the new book, Arab Voices, what they are saying to us, and why it matters. We also thank our audience here as well as on radio and the Internet. This program has been held in association with the Commonwealth Club's Middle East Forum. We want to remind everyone here that copies of Dr. Zoghbi's new book, Arab Voices, is available outside, and he will sign copies in this room immediately following the program. I'm Robert Rosenthal, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.